All right, welcome to the Volterra podcast number 9. It's just me in the studio today. Louis is MIA, so I'm here with Tom Wilton from Cinema Zero. How are we doing today, Tom?
I'm good. How are you doing, Rowan?
I'm doing all right. So we'll get right into it. Tom, you've got a film coming out on the 23rd.
Yeah. Right? That's correct, yeah. Releases on the 23rd in New York, and also as a digital download. So we've got a screening in New York City, digital download, and then on the 24th we've got a screening in LA as well. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So it's a bit of a unique distribution method, correct? The premiere, the multiple premieres combined with a digital download.
Yeah. So, essentially, this is my third release. So this film, Let It Go, is the third feature that I'll be releasing. But it's the first time I've decided to do it entirely on my own, essentially, or without the support of a distributor. So the idea is simply that we release the film on the 23rd theatrically, so just one screening and potentially more if the first screening goes well. But also making it available on the day of release via a download. And anyone who attends the film screening will also get the download as well, a DRM-free download. So it's a little bit sort of merging the old model and the new model, a bit of a mashup. I guess we'll see if it works or not.
Yeah. So we'll get into that the actual film a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But this distribution, this kind of new way of putting your films out there, It kind of links in with your other project called Cinema Zero, correct? You want to tell us a little bit about Cinema Zero?
Yeah, so Cinema Zero is a website that was started. It launched in March, and the first film went live in April. And the concept for Cinema Zero is pretty straightforward. The idea is to have a place online where you screen independent films one at a time. So essentially, like a small art house movie theater, a small art house cinema that you might go to, where you basically have such a limited release that there's literally only one screen available to screen one film at a time. So Cinema Zero, we curate movies and we showcase them literally for about a week at a time. And what happens is it's all backed up by an interview, very similar to this, like a podcast essentially. And then, you know, just sort of try and build some noise around that film, get some exposure for it, and then, you know, once that week is up, we move on to the next movie. So it's going well. It's going really, really well, and I'm really pleased with the reception to it so far.
Very nice. So there was just, I just got a phone call, so sorry about that. Mm-hmm. We'll try and cut this out and on the review. So you're in small art house, right? So where did you get this idea for Cinema Zero and where did you get the name Cinema Zero itself?
Okay, so the idea to start with the first part of that, the idea was simply I have a terrible habit of having random ideas just pop up out of nowhere based on the problems that I currently see. Now, obviously, being in film for such a long time and being in independent film, I recognize that the biggest issue for independent film and filmmakers isn't necessarily making a film. It's actually relatively easy these days to shoot a film. You know, for a few thousand dollars, you can make a pretty good independent film in terms of production value. The biggest problem is actually discovery, and I recognize that YouTube I did some research. YouTube is the second biggest search engine in the world, the biggest video player in the world. You know, so there's a huge platform there if you want a place to put your film. The problem is the film being discovered because it's so big. It's literally, your film becomes a needle in a haystack. And so what I realized was independent film, for it to have a chance of being discovered, or, you know, new filmmakers, because it's all about, you know, people go and see a movie based on who's in it or who they know or who the director is. And the problem is getting that kind of awareness. And So I recognized that we had this huge platform, these huge opportunities to distribute films essentially for zero, like for nothing. But the biggest problem wasn't then the barrier to entry in terms of cost. The problem became discovery, you know, and it's all good and well having a huge platform that didn't exist 10 years ago, but it's no good if nobody knows you're there. So what I recognized was, okay, how do we, you know, bring a bit of focus to this? And so the idea was, the name for Cinema Zero, to answer the second part of your question, really comes from the idea of saying, well, if you were to build a film theater today, if you were to literally go, hey, you know, I want to screen films, I want to build a film theater, what would you do? So it was essentially starting from zero. So that's the idea. If you were start from zero, start from scratch, what would be the approach you would take? Because often what you see is a lot of these things are based on, you know, people try to iterate on what's come before, try to iterate on what's already in existence. But I tried to kind of think, well, if we started this business today, if the cinema business started today, what would it look like? And then I recognized, well, it would be just a website. It would be a website, but it would have, but it would be about saying, hey, we've got this film for a certain runtime. Because the one thing about the internet is it gives you infinity, it gives you, or almost infinity in terms of how long the film is available, you know. But the difficulty of it is with everything being available all the time, it's very hard to get people's attention and their focus. And so that was the basic concept, is how can we bring a little bit of focus to some very, very special movies. And so that's where it started.
That's awesome. So what kind of strategies have you been using to get your own, to get Cinema Zero itself out, and to kind of to build the viewership of your own website, so that you can then in turn get these young and upcoming filmmakers out?
I recognize it. So there's a couple of there's a lot of things to it. So first things first, you have to recognize who your network is, who you know, basically. So obviously the first thing was to talk about it on Facebook. And over the years, I used to run a film festival called the Bootleg Film Festival, which ran for 5 years. And so through that, I had a fairly sizable, you know, network of filmmakers already. But then I recognized that that only goes to carries you so far. So the idea was to initially announce it to those guys and invite everybody to basically submit films, and, you know, those networks talk to their networks. But there's a definite ceiling of growth. You know, there's a definite like point where you go, this is great, I've had, you know, 2,000 people view the website this month, and then it drops, and then it stops, you know.
Right.
So what I recognized then was, okay, well, how do I talk to an even broader audience? And I found Reddit to be actually very useful. You know, there's a subreddit for filmmakers. That was quite useful. But again, like, these are all kind of stages of growth, and then you realize when you've exhausted something. So then I recognized, well, what is it that Cinema Zero offers? Essentially, you know, I started with the core, which was to screen these films, and then I recognized, well, maybe it's also a little information these filmmakers need, you know. So we launched the audio podcast, which basically took our initial video feed, and then we built in the audio recordings, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we grew on that side, and then I recognized that a lot of filmmakers have the same questions. It's like any industry. It's like if you, for example, you're going to become a mechanic, you know, there may have been 100 mechanics pass through the same workshop over the previous decades, but you're still going to have the same questions as the mechanics did on their first date. So even though this information has been well-versed and has been spread 1,000 times, the fact always remains that people still come up with the same questions because the information doesn't last. So this is where I decided to start writing a blog post and asking, you know, writing stuff myself about my experiences and inviting other filmmakers to come and talk about their experiences and just building more of a resource, a community, and more less about, you know, this is how you do this, but much more these have been my experiences and the philosophical ideas behind the film, and, you know, tried to make it a bit more, a little bit less, you know, listicles, and a little more focused on this is how it is at the moment, and this is going to change. So to answer your question in a really roundabout way, I've tried to add additional value to the site and to get and experiment, really, I think is the key thing, is to try new things, and if something works, keep it. If it doesn't work, throw it away and evolve everything, essentially.
Yeah, so that's kind of something that I've been trying to do with this project, with the Volterra, is build it around quality rather than trying to get clickbait, basically, because the ease of which people can just put headlines up to get clicks and get traffic to their website and then monetize that is certainly one way to do it. But that's not. I think we're both on the same page in terms of building a project around what we actually care about and what we want to do. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I've been having a conversation with a guy that he's in the fashion industry. He's a blogger, and I've just been working on New York Fashion Week, and as a freelancer. And I was talking to this guy, very very. Very lovely guy, and he was talking about his website. And we were discussing essentially just a lot of this sort of stuff, which is he's kind of pushing back against the fast information, the kind of the sugar rush that you get, from reading, and he said, there have been times where he's written articles that are 30 words long, just because he wants that to show up on a feed or to get shared. And then he realized that, it wasn't, there was no value for him. Like, as a writer, and I talked about how I'd written a 9,000 page piece and put it down. Sorry, 9,000 pages. That's War and Peace, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's Harry Potter times,
But 9,000 word piece, and then broke it down into, because again, it's like, it's okay writing long form content, but you also have to make it digestible. So, exploring an idea, but then break it down to chapters, essentially breaking down to individual blog posts. And I think there is a real space for, especially as a pushback, because we're so used to going onto Facebook and literally we're hit with, BuzzFeed this and
listicle upon listicle upon listicle. Yeah.
It's like, okay, it's fine, what do you take away from it? What resonates from you? What are you learning from it? What happens when you read something that has no substance? Like, you've essentially wasted 5 seconds of, or even 5 minutes of
Facebook. Or, half an hour. Christ almighty. It's,
I think long form is definitely the way to go. I think it's a good way to go.
Yeah. So along those same lines, the industry, the film industry has taken I'll put the question this way. And this is a very broad question, but I think that we've kind of hinted at some answers to it. Where do you see the film industry right now, and where do you see the film industry going in the next kind of 5, 10, 15, 20 years as projects like yours hopefully solidify, and as the Hollywood and the major houses continue to make kind of
I think
subpar films?
Well, it's funny because there's a lot of answers to this. And first things first, I would say the business is in transition. Maybe it's not even in transition; it's in evolution. Really, that's really what's happening. And so, like in, and again, I'm going to use a metaphor here, but like in terms of Darwin's evolution. Not all species move forward. Some will evolve from become a subspecies. So essentially, I think that what's happening with independent film is, I think Hollywood's going to remain. I don't think that's changing. And I think there's a lot of,
too massive.
Yep. Too clever. There are people who work in production who went to law school. So there are people who are working as producers. Didn't intend to become producers. Who literally have degrees in biochemistry, for goodness sake. So these aren't silly people. These are very smart, savvy people. They just applied their skill sets elsewhere. So I think Hollywood's going to do just fine. And there's a lot of people that keep, there's a lot of people saying Hollywood's over, this is the death of Hollywood. It really isn't.
No.
I think this is about an evolution of a subspecies, and it's the whole concept of saying, independent film no longer has to suckle from Hollywood, which was the old model. You know, it was almost the sense of like, we will help you indie filmmakers to get strong and become good filmmakers, and then we'll invite you to Hollywood. And that's essentially what the independent model used to do. I think now it's completely self-sufficient, and because of the nature of the internet alone, and people, and I think personally, I have a personal investment in this, but having seen how difficult it is to screen films on a grand scale, having seen how difficult it is to find a broad audience, I recognize that independent film is better served almost directly to the internet. And the internet is starting, or the internet, or internet companies are starting to become savvy to this, because, Netflix was a joke. You know, Netflix was a running joke when they started the internet streaming. It was like this idea of going, hey, you know, we send DVDs to you in the mail. We're going to just try this other thing, but like, that's not our main business.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, 5-6 years later, everybody has a Netflix account because $8-10 a month, you know, that's cheaper than a movie ticket, you know. And the quality, and the key thing is the quality of the films has improved. And what I've recognized is that the growth of Netflix, which basically legitimized the idea of internet distribution, means that for independent filmmakers like me, or people who are making web series, and I hate that phrase web series, it's a horrible, cheap phrase to use, making series, making shows, however they distribute, doesn't really matter anymore, because essentially it's about whether or not it's good, and if you make something that's good, an audience will find it, and I think that's only going to increase over the next 5-10 years. And I think that to try and sort of give you a clear answer, I think what's going to happen is Hollywood will remain. There will always be huge blockbuster movies, and then all the independent filmmakers, or majority of the independent filmmakers, will have a natural home on the internet with their own natural fan base, which will have found them through sites like Cinema Zero and the multitude of others that I have no doubt will pop up over the next few years.
So basically, there's a lot to unpack in that answer. So you're kind of, if I get this right, that you're what you're saying is just there's almost going to be parallel film industries, the Hollywood kind of pop culture, massive for mass consumption, and then an indie not medium, but an indie line that is more cultural, more artistic, more kind of refined. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I'd say absolutely. I mean, you know, let's shift the industry for a moment. Let's say, even if we were looking at what's happening with radio at the moment, you know, not even music. Music's always a straight analogy, but let's look at radio, for example. Suddenly, we've got this whole vibrant community of podcasters. It's taken about 10 years to get to this point, but they're as legitimized now as switching on the radio in the car, you know? And so I think that rather than one eating the other, or, you know, one collapsing because the other one rose, I think it becomes they just become almost equal, and it's like interchangeable in a lot of ways now. And so what I think is that independent film will, because it becomes cheaper to distribute, will therefore be easier to find finance, and because audiences are easier to find, and it's all word of mouth. You know, that's the key thing. It's like, if you make a good product and somebody likes it, they're going to, you know, it will come up in conversation, and somebody else will be encouraged to find it. And, you know, eventually you hit a critical mass. I'm not saying that's going to happen to every film, but I definitely feel that there's going to be a lot of platforms that do hit that critical mass that then give access to those films, you know. So it's not so much the movies hitting the critical mass, it's more the kind of the NPR model or the PRX model, or it's the whole kind of, we've curated these programs for you, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So here's another kind of question to build on to that. You live in New York.
Yeah.
I live in Connecticut. You're from the UK, yeah. London, the kind of cities. Is this do indie films ever kind of reach the heartlands of, do they ever get to Kansas? Do they ever get to Nebraska? Do they ever get to, I don't know, Luton or or someplace like that, that's kind of a not exactly a cultural epicenter. Can they spread to those areas, or are they kind of, or will they remain this kind of, I don't know, not niche to any degree, but a kind of smaller audience?
If you'd asked me that question 3 years ago, I'd have said no. Purely because what you will find in a lot of these places, so say for example you go to, I don't know, if you go like you go into the Midwest, or you know, you go to some sort of like small town on the outskirts of a big city, their film theaters now are essentially would traditionally be in the big city, an art house theater, but that's the only theater they've got. So they will only ever have maybe one or two screens, maybe three screens if they're lucky. And what will happen is the big movies, when they eventually roll out to that region, will go and play there, because then, you know, and again, this is a huge generalization of these places. I know they're all very culturally diverse, but a lot of times it will be, I mean, you know, for example, you know, you studied in Scotland, you went to St. Andrews. I've seen the film theater at St. Andrews. It's, you know, and the movie I saw, this beautiful old-fashioned film theater, and they had Man of Steel on. You know, so it was like, okay, that I understand. However, because I think that the proliferation of the internet breaking down so many barriers, I think that, you know, if somebody in, you know, in who is, you know, 400, 500, 1,000 miles away from New York or LA can go online and discover, you know, the latest band via Spotify, then they can absolutely discover the latest cool films, you know, coming from a filmmaker. I mean, not even necessarily in New York, but in, say, Helsinki or, you know, wherever they are. And that's one of the reasons that I really love doing Cinema Zero, for example, is that we've had viewership. So, you know, obviously I look at my analytics, and we've had people watching films from as far away as Vietnam, as far away as, India is one of our biggest audiences, ironically. And so we have these people from around the world, from, you know, parts of Scandinavia, Australia, wherever you name it. We've screened in over 84 countries so far. And the idea is simply, and the reason why that's working is, anywhere there's an internet connection available, you can watch those films. That's all it is. That's all you need, is an internet connection. You know, and so it'll play on your phone, your iPad, your, you know, whatever it is you've got. You press play, you get a movie.
So this is the kind of democratization of art, of culture, of its. Mm-hmm. Art. The indie film isn't for guys in black turtlenecks with berets smoking a cigarette in Paris and London and Soho anymore.
Yeah, and which may, I don't mean, it may have been the case previously. Maybe in the 60s, you were making it for the college students in New York or the college students in LA, you know, because that was the only place you were going to get seen. That was the only place you were going to get your film seen. So you tried to speak to that audience, and that audience tried to invoke or take on some of the messages of your work. Nowadays, literally, I mean, you know, the fact that I can screen a film from, you know, from the US, and for that movie to then play, you know, in Hong Kong, you know, culturally, you know, very diverse, culturally very different, and yet, you know, because English is such a huge language now, and obviously films that aren't in English tend to be subtitled in English, the films travel so far and wide, and so now your audience doesn't necessarily have to come from, you know, one of these major hub cities, you know, London, Paris, you know, Berlin. They can come from anywhere, and that's what I love about it. And I think that means that independent film especially is suddenly very, very, very exciting, because we do get to do what Hollywood does, which is mass distribution. You know, we didn't used to get to do that. We now have an opportunity to do mass distribution. I think that's something that we should all be doing. Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of mass distribution, you have your own film, Let It Go, coming out in, what's today?
Today is the 12th.
12th, so it comes out in 11 days, is that correct?
Yeah, 11 days, yeah.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Let It Go?
Okay, so So there's two elements. So there's obviously the distribution element, and there's also the film itself. So the film itself is a very simple comedy. It's about a guy who decides to ask his girlfriend to get married, and ironically enough, on the same day he decides to ask her to be his wife, she's deciding to break up with him. So they have this awkward conversation at the beginning of the film, and the film essentially, the story then follows the fallout of their breakup. But it's dealt with in a very, it's not a heavy drama at all, by any stretch of the imagination, but it's hopefully still true to some of the difficulties. And so you've got, on one side, her best friend is a guy, and on his side, his best friend is a girl, and it's how...
Played by your writing partner and co-director and life partner, Maria McIndoe.
Yeah, Maria McIndoe, who is probably, it's funny because so me and Maria, so we wrote the film together. She's in the movie. She's extremely funny. I'm not just saying that because obviously you know her, or that anyone who knows me knows that I'll gush about her, but she is incredible. She's very, very talented, talented writer, filmmaker, and indeed actor. So Maria's in the movie. There's also Gillian Visco, who I've worked with before on previous projects. She plays Steph, the girl who breaks up with Jeremy, who is played by Andrew Leland Rogers. And then rounding out our main cast is Josh Hawkins, who, funny enough, plays an American in this movie, but he grew up about 10-15 minutes from where I did in London. So it was something quite sweet about, you know, having a fellow South East Londoner on set with me. It was a lot of fun. But the cast are just, they're great. They're incredible people and very talented.
So were there any awkward conversations when you were writing this between you and Maria, or was it because you guys got married and these folks are, well, one of them wants to get married, but the other one is
It was. There was a lot of the awkward conversations were much more around. So we have very different styles of writing styles, and so you know it's a real test of not just a marriage, but of a working relationship, where you can go, hey, I don't really think that we should be doing that in this scene. Like, I think maybe we need to do this. So the general way we worked was essentially I wrote the majority of it. And then what would happen is I'd give it to Maria, and she would come in and essentially rewrite whole segments or take out stuff or add stuff in. So essentially, and then I would come back and I would look at it and go, okay, I like this, I don't like this. And then we would essentially talk about it. So the conversations were never, there were never any arguments over it, but there were definitely moments where I'd say, no, I think it needs to be this way. And she would disagree. And actually the biggest issue, and I don't know how much you'll thank me for bringing this one up, but the biggest issue was filming it in black and white. I was very adamant from day one that it was going to be black and white. And she was unsure. She just felt that it was a... I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I think she felt it was just... there was no obvious reason. It was just a cheap move. But I was very adamant that it had to look photogenically good. I wanted it to feel like every frame was a composed photograph. You know, I wanted it to look, because it was, I was challenging myself as a cinematographer, and I knew that I wanted to move my style on from the normal handheld stuff that I would traditionally do. Yeah. So I said I want to shoot it predominantly locked off on a tripod, you know, essentially on sticks for most of the movie, and black and white. And there was some bones of contention over whether it should be black and white or not. And I had to be very insistent that as the director, I was, you know, adamant it would be black and white. And I give her a due. She saw it and she acknowledged that why I'd wanted to do it that way. But for the most part, there has definitely been points where Maria said to me, hey, it needs to be this. And I've said, no, it can't be that. And she said, no, it has to be this. And we've gone her way. And I've stood back and gone, you know what, you were right all along. So it's quite, it's a lot of fun, actually. It's a real test of your own ego, you know, when you can work along somebody that, you know, is essentially your partner in life as well as on the project. And you can, it's not necessarily giving in, no, and even compromise, it didn't even come down to compromise. It's just trusting that their vision is correct. And that's really what it came down to.
Yeah. So there was a 15-minute teaser that you guys put out a couple weeks ago. I watched that, and the conversation between the couple isn't actually audible.
No,
it's all visual. So can you talk about that little scene?
So that was one of
It's a big scene, but I would imagine it's a pivotal scene, but. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, there's a couple of things. So I knew that as soon as I decided on the style of it, and funny because we were talking about music and Maria said it should be jazz, like old jazz should play.
Oh, the music, that was perfect, by the way. The music in the back was the background music or the audio that was over that was perfect. So sorry, go ahead.
So very early on, like, you know, we obviously have roof access here, and I thought, I really want to shoot a scene, but I thought, because it's such a difficult scene to shoot, like in terms of what's said and the emotions that you're asking these characters to go through, I thought it's very invasive to zoom in on somebody, you know, even if they're acting, it's very invasive for an audience member to sit there and go, oh wow, she's breaking his heart at the moment, you know, especially so early on in the movie. It sets the tone for the rest of the movie. And I realized that I always wanted it stepped right back, and I thought we can do enough with the setup in advance, saying what's going to happen, and then it, you know, show it. And then I thought, well, that would be the perfect time for the title sequence, which again gave it that old movie feel, the old kind of fashion styling. And so it was very, and of course, and it was the coldest day we could have picked. We didn't shoot here. We didn't shoot in Queens. We shot in Brooklyn. Andrew's apartment, ironically, the guy who's in the movie, but he had a beautiful view of Manhattan in the background. So very straight away, the shot serves a number of purposes, not least of which is telling people that the main story happens in New York City. But you know, but what was really lovely about it was the view was great, and we were all ready to go, and then we got up there, and it was, I think it was January 5th we shot that scene. I remember being very early January, and it was so cold and so windy that even though I had the camera on the tripod, I was literally holding the tripod down because the wind was so high. And you'll see in the shot, they get blown around quite a bit in their faces. And so it was, the idea was that it was meant to be his idea of a romantic moment, and yet, you know, it just kind of worked out perfectly. They get up there and it's like this windy, cold day, and it was his idea that it would be romantic to propose with Manhattan in the background, and instead she's like, it's over, buddy, game over.
So just as a kind of behind the scenes question, what were they actually talking about during that? Do you want to get dinner after this? Absolutely, I want to get dinner after this. What do you? Yeah, was it that kind of thing, or were they actually kind of in character and?
They were the pair. Both Gillian and Andrew are such dedicated performers that they stayed in character, and it was all in character. And I think we did about four or five takes, and every single one, you know. And Andrew is very committed to, you know, living through his emotions, and Gillian is so good at delivering those beats. So, you know, I think that they knew that was going to be, you know, even though they weren't mic'd, and even though they were going to get no dialogue on the scene, they both wanted it to be very, you know, they wanted it to be real. So yeah, they performed the scene. Yeah, they did it.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you want to add about the film itself?
No, the film itself is, all I want to say is you're going to love it. I know it sounds very, very confident, but I promise people that this is the one I'm most proud of, and I think everyone in the movie did a great job, and so, and I'd love to, if you get to see it, I'd love to hear what they think of it. I'm extremely proud of it, so yeah, I'm happy with it.
I'm actually going to try and get down to New York on the 23rd. If I can't, I'll watch it via the internet.
Yeah.
How can folks get in touch or get?
So we're trying something new. Obviously, we're making the film available on the day of release. The way to get hold of the film is it's basically $5. It's $5. You can download the film on the 23rd. It's DRM free, so you can watch it anywhere you like. Best place to go is to Cinema Zero. So cinema-zero.com. And then if you look on there, there's a little tab that says distribution. and there's all the options to see the film. But just, yeah, check out the site. And then, and of course, while you're on Cinema Zero, there's everything else in there as well. And it explains a bit about why we're doing this distribution model as well.
Great. You can also be you can also follow you on Twitter at, what is it?
At Tom Wilton. Very, very easy. So at TomWilton. So at Tom Wilton, nice and easy. And at Cinema Zero is even easier. So it's at CMZRO, or Z if I'm in
America. If you're on this continent. Yes. Well, thank you for coming on, Tom. I truly appreciate it. We'll have to check back in after the premiere and in the next couple months and see how everything's going.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Ryan. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Absolutely. Have a good one, Tom.
Yes, bye now.
Bye now.